Welcome to yet another episode of the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. I know it has been a while since the last episode, but it has not been easy to find people that I believe are worthwhile to come on the podcast. Today's guest definitely fits all what I look for. I had the pleasure to be joined by Ulrike Scheider, author of two great books on Japanese business, to discuss the transition that Japan is currently undergoing. We talk about the bubble period, Japan's transition to the niche economy, and other major trends taking place in digitization and the labor market. Don't forget, you can check all of my work at bestanchorstocks.com, and you can also purchase Ulrike's books to go more in depth into the topics we discussed in this episode. I hope you enjoy the episode, and it would help me quite a bit if you left a review on Spotify or Apple Podcast and shared the podcast with whoever might be interested. Well, today I have the pleasure of having Ulrike Scheider in the podcast. I'm going to give a brief introduction about Ulrike, and I think it's going to be a good segue into what we're going to discuss today. So Ulrike is the professor of Japanese business at the UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy, and also the founding director of the Japan Forum for Innovation and Technology. And the way I got to know Ulrike actually is by reading her two books. She's authored two books, which you can see here. One is The Business Reinvention of Japan, and the other one is Japan Reemerges. So I think it's pretty obvious what we're going to talk about today, which is Japan. Ulrike, I think it would be a great idea if you start maybe by giving some context on how you became interested in Japan and how you pursued a career in Japanese business.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for having me. I got interested in Japan when Japan was an economic powerhouse, way back when, so in the 80s, 90s. And Americans also got very interested in Japan because they saw an opportunity to make money. In particular, there was something called the Japan-US trade dispute. And the American government was forcing the Japanese government to open up its financial markets. And Wall Street thought that this was a great opportunity to go to Japan. So I got very interested in this. And I was a student in Germany at the time. And I wrote my PhD thesis about the deregulation of financial markets, and in particular, the introduction of financial futures. And, you know, there's a funny side story there. It turns out the first financial futures market in the world that we know of and have any detailed information about opened in 1730 in Dojima, which is in Osaka. Mm. It was a rice futures market. So anyway, I wrote the dissertation about that, and nobody in Germany cared about financial futures in Japan. It was very interesting, but the Americans were very eager. In the process, I switched to teaching at the University of California and have then made studying Japan sort of my interest. I got away from finance a little bit for a while because there were other things that I thought were even more interesting, like how companies are managed and how CEOs were taking the 20th century business model and turning it into, you know, a 21st century competitive model. And then, of course, as we all know, China rose. Suddenly, everybody got interested in China, and the interest in Japan subsided quite a bit. But lately, and that's the title of my book, right? Japan Reemerges. As China, you know, maybe we think we know what we need to know. I don't know whether that's true, but there's a new interest in Japan. And what was interesting all the while was that the Americans thought that Germany and Japan were the same, or roughly the same. And that was not my experience. I grew up in Germany, and I thought, oh, Japan is different and does things differently. And those differences, I think I felt even as a young person, I felt that they would persist and that I could always do research on Japan because there would always be something quite not like what we think it is or what we expect it to be. And so I made Japan my research focus.
I must say that when I traveled to Japan around a year ago, I always describe it as probably the only developed economy where the culture is really different. So where globalization probably has not made it similar to other countries, because as a European, if you go to the US, sure, it's different, but you're going to see a lot of the things that you see in Europe already, right? But Japan really struck me as a very independent-minded society that is a globalized country, obviously trades with the outside, but they have managed to keep their culture. Maybe before going into the transition that Japan has conducted or is still conducting over the past few years, I think it's interesting if we talk about the context of Japan, right? These were like a golden decade for the country. I mean, there was a huge bubble in the stock market. Just some interesting data. The Nikkei index appreciated, I think, fivefold in the decade. And in the four final years, it was 200%, a 200% gain. So what would you say were the causes of the financial bubble? And then how do you think the bubble burst affected society and business and the business landscape in general?
Yeah, that's a deep question. I mean, Eugene Farmer from Chicago would say there's no bubble, but that's the... what happened was, in my view, and you ask 10 people, you get a slightly different version of the same story, but my interpretation of what happened there is that after World War II, you know, Japan was flattened. 40% of its productive capacity had been destroyed. And there was this effort, this what Thomas Johnson then called the developmental state effort, to catch up with the West. And what was meant by that was the, you know, acquiring the technologies, but also learning operations management and, you know, production processes from the West, so some Germany and so forth, and Italy and the UK, but mostly America. And so this, there was an entire machinery was put together that would allow Japan to catch up. And it was a phenomenal success story. It worked. So by the early 1980s, Japan had actually figured out how to make, you know, nifty consumer electronics, and, you know, and then miniaturized them. And then came the Sony radio, 1979, the Sony Walkman was, of course, a game changer in how we think about what we do while we walk. And so there was all of that, that, you know, culminated in the early 1980s, of course, the automobiles, right? So Toyota figured out how to make, and Nissan figured out how to make high quality small cars with great gas mileage. And in the early 80s, Japan began to have a huge trade surplus with the United States. You know, Americans just love these products. And it was as if Japan had arrived. Now, the catch-up had succeeded. So, and then the Americans came in and said, well, you can't do this. We have this trade deficit. You have to deregulate your finances. And we have to change the yen-dollar exchange rate because this trade deficit is too big. It's a little bit to what we hear right now.
Actually. Yeah, I think it sounds familiar.
Yeah. It's actually a similar playbook, because the current politicians that do this in America were actually young people then, and so they remember that. So Japan opened its financial markets, and that was a shock to the exporters. So the Bank of Japan propped up the monetary base. And so there was a lot of liquidity in the system, and everybody was having a party. We have arrived. Right. And so hubris came in, and that's the bubble element. And so there was, a lot of companies started financial engineering, and they had these huge finance departments where they would, issue, debt to, build something and then issue more equity, and the stock market went nuts, and they would put money in real estate and the house of cards, and you know how bubbles work. By 1990, it became clear that this was excessive and exuberant, and the Bank of Japan started raising interest rates, and the whole thing came to a screeching halt. It didn't come to a screeching halt. It actually came to a screeching halt, but people were in denial. So then there was a sort of the early 90s were muddling through and waiting for it to pop back up, and we're so great, and that didn't happen. So by 1997, 98, Japan fell into a huge banking crisis because these companies had all of these non-performing loans, and it became clear that they had built these house of card constructions. So by the early 2000s, the banking crisis was cleaned up. But the companies were still sitting on a lot of businesses. So at its height, Hitachi had over 1,000 subsidiaries and was in what they claimed 10 businesses. I would think of it much more, but basically everything from rice cookers to nuclear power plants. And in between, you get construction equipment, medical equipment, hard disk drives, you know, Shinkansen trains. And it's a crazy conglomeration of, you know, business units with no some core competencies around, but no clear vision. And then where it gets interesting is how the government then said, okay, so we've got to change. Well, everybody knew we got to change. One more thing to the story. While the Japanese were having their banking crisis and you know, struggling with these conglomerates, in the late 90s, South Korea and then Taiwan and then China had managed to learn, copy, adopt Japan's production techniques and had become formidable competitors in consumer electronics. And so the rice cooker, since I mentioned it, the rice cooker suddenly, Korean companies or Chinese companies could also make rice cookers at a very high yield, you know, nice that part. So there was a new competition in Northeast Asia, which I think is then the next story. But let me give you a chance to answer the next question. So that's the sort of the background to what we're seeing now.
I think even many American businesses, right, try to copy Japanese production systems, right? Danaher, which is a huge business in the US, they actually have the Danaher business system, which is as its name suggests, a business system. And they brought that from the Toyota production system. They actually had the Japanese come to the US and learn how to operate all the Kaizen methodology and everything. So it's interesting how Japan had this competitive advantage on production, and that helped them dominate mass technology. But then, as you said, other Asian economies started to catch up. So then Japan was, let's say, rendered less competitive, and they had to transition, right? And that's the content of your books, how Japan has transitioned from mass technology, what we also, I even remember when I was a kid that everything that has something of technology in it was Japanese. And then that started to change. And now we don't see as many Japanese products, but we depend on them, right? So maybe if you can explain that transition from mass technology to more dominating high value niches.
Yeah, so one quick thing on the Toyota production system, which is actually very interesting and will tie into what I'm going to say next. So in the late 80s, early 90s, when Japan was strong, the American economy was not strong. We were beginning to lose manufacturing in the US. And so there was a lot of soul searching in America what to do about this. And the business schools here started to study how Japan does organization behavior, human resource management, culture management, and then, of course, operations management. And the Toyota production system actually was never a secret, right? It was the first book on it was written in 1964. It was developed in Toyota City as a sort of a new way of building cars of mass production. And it effectively has replaced the Taylor production system globally. So that every car company in the world has adopted the Toyota production system. And yet experts who study this sort of thing to the minute detail tell me that nobody can build cars like Toyota still to this day. And it's an interesting story of what the Japanese call monozukuri, which really means the art of making things. Everybody knows the elements of the Toyota production system, but implementing it and executing it is something that really, I mean, if you want to see the pure form of that, you actually still to this day have to travel to the
IT. Yeah, that's actually similar to Danaher in the sense that a lot of investors ask them, okay, you have DBS, everyone knows how that works. Why isn't it copied? And they say, because it's not about knowing how it works. It's about applying it every day and having it be part of the culture. And probably Toyota has that as part of the culture. And even if other companies want to embrace it, you basically don't have maybe a workforce that's prepared to embrace the Toyota production system as it is embraced in Toyota.
Yeah, it requires a huge attention to detail. But in the United States, actually, other industries have tried to adopt it, like from law firm and doctor's offices to, you know, all kinds of places. about the constant flow and, you know, optimizing the flow and having the parts ready when you need them, just-in-time delivery, right? So make it, get the parts when you need them and make the car when you need it. So it's all this one thing. So anyway, that's a great segue to what happened next in Japan, because Japan had that, right? And Japan also, I don't know whether you remember this, but when we started using cell phones, the Japanese companies were at the top of the world. They were just 4 or 5 years ahead of us. And NTT Docomo had something called iMode. And the lore is that the Japanese high school kids, the girls, high school girls, it's actually attributed to them, wanted a camera on their phone so that they could take a picture of this girl that they met and then not confuse them with somebody else. That's how we ended up with cameras on phones, or so the story goes. Apple made its iPhone in, you know, I think it debuted in 2006 or 2007, something like that. And Docomo had already had this, basically this internet-based phone technology, but had failed in rolling it out globally, the typical case of being too early. We were not ready for a phone where we could go on the internet and have a camera and that sort of thing. So Apple was looking for suppliers for the iPhone, which was, of course, a game changer. Found them in Japan. At the time, Apple was very secretive about who was making parts for the iPhone, but we now know that more than half of the suppliers to the original iPhone were in Japan. And that's how I got interested in this. Right? So I was looking at, okay, who actually makes the iPhone? We know Apple's business model. Right? They design the stuff in Cupertino, and then they sell it in these glitzy stores, but everything in the middle is outsourced, which is, of course, now also an issue here. And so I found a study from the Asia Development Bank Institute, Research Institute. They'd taken it apart, the iPhone, the original one. And at the time, it sold at $600, and it cost $200 to make it, give or take. And 34% of the value added of that phone were made in Japan. And then another 17% in Germany, because the liquid crystals that float around in that screen, actually there's one company in Germany that made those. And the Chinese contribution, basically putting it together, added 3.6% of value added. So then I said, okay, that's very cool. So with each iPhone sold, somebody in Japan earns $60, right? So who is that somebody? So I went to study those companies. And what I learned was that there's a new Japanese strength in input materials and the production machinery needed to make these very advanced, sort of super high value added pieces, you know, for the iPhone and other things. And at the time in Asia, the concept of the smile curve became very popular. I don't know whether you've heard about it.
I think you touch it in your book, right?
Yeah, it's in the book. And so as the story goes, it's a good story. The CEO of Acer in the mid-90s was sitting in some beer place, and on a napkin, he drew a U-shaped, sort of smile-shaped curve, with the axes being some measure of profit, operating margin or something, and the stages of production. So if you think about this, right, so it's a U. So that means the stages of production go from design to retail. Then you get this U. So the money is in the design, the input materials, the input parts. Then comes assembly at the bottom of the U. And then the, you know, whatever, wherever you buy it, whether that's Amazon or, you know, your local electronics store, adds a huge margin. And for Acer and Taiwan in general at the time, this was before TSMC, right? This was a problem because the entry of China had wiped out the margins in the assembly. And then the Japanese companies looked at that and said, whoa, that was our, right? Toyota Production said, this is our bailiwick. We are the assemblers of the world. We have figured out how to do super high-end consumer electronics, very high yields, high quality. We're done in. And so Japan's leading companies, the front runners of this shift that I'm observing, began to relinquish the consumer end product or the commoditized product, whether that's in chemistry or electronics or industry after industry, move away, move into the higher margin places. And in manufacturing, of course, that was about the input parts and components, and auto parts and the, you know, construction machinery parts, precision machinery parts. And then Korea and Taiwan got better and better at that. And then the Japanese company said, okay, fine, we can't compete with that. So let's move into the materials and the processes and the production equipment needed to make this. And so if you think about a semiconductor, and it has, of course, you know, it starts with rare earth, and then it goes all the way to, you know, there's some chemicals and photoresists and so forth, and it gets stitched onto the wafer, and then it gets packaged, and then it becomes a thing that can go into some part or car or something. And Japan actually dominates the chemicals and materials that are needed to make excellent, you know, photoresists. So not just the wafer, but the, you know, whatever's on the
wafer. Yeah, the coating for the lithography step. You basically can't make a high-end chip without Japan.
That's correct. You cannot package it, but because these high-end packaging technologies are also super complicated now, and there's some new materials that Japanese companies keep developing. So as you look at your phone, or you mentioned earlier, right? We used to see Japanese branded things everywhere. You walk into somebody's living room, and there's a Sony TV and a Panasonic, this or that, right? And that's no longer there. And the reason is not that Japan is gone, but what I call Japan inside. And I don't know, you know, whether that's actually still the case, but there was a time when every single Windows machine that had an Intel chip in it had a little sticker that said Intel inside. I think they still do that. If there's an Intel chip in your computer, there's a little sticker that tells you there's an Intel inside. There's no sticker that tells you that there's a Japan inside. We don't know, except there's a 0.6 probability that that camera in your phone is driven by a Sony chip, vision sensor, right? So there are very high end parts in this thing. So the interesting part of this is that even the people who take this apart have a hard time figuring out
where it's coming from.
Yeah, they can trace the parts to South Korea and Taiwan and so forth, but they cannot trace the materials.
I mean, you know that there's a chip there, but you don't know what suppliers enable the manufacturing of that chip.
And I'm told that some 94% of Korean production machinery, so whatever Samsung uses to make chips, is actually from Japan. So there's also that element, right? So there's the Japanese government has put data together for this, and they have looked at five industries: automobiles and car parts, electronics and electronic parts, and biotech. They've picked, it's not an academic study, right? So they've very purposefully picked 1,000 parts and input parts where, you know, that are important to make these things. And they looked at the combined market share of Japanese companies in each of these. And so there's a little chart I have in my book. It's a little complicated when you first look at it. What's interesting about that chart is that there are many somewhat smaller industries, if I may call them, or products. You know, maybe a global market size of $5 billion, $7 billion, where Japanese companies combine to more than 50% of global market share, or even 100% of global market share. So there's actually a part in the automatic transmission of a car where Japanese companies have 100% global market share. That is, unless you drive a stick shift, you could not drive your car without Japan.
Hey listeners, my name is Brett Schaefer, one of the hosts of the Chit Chat Stocks podcast. On our show, we do comprehensive stock research reports, interview analysts, and learn from great investors. And we have coverage on stocks like Airbnb, Nubank, Mercado Libre, and many others. Plus, we cover all the hot financial news on our weekly investing power hours. We have episodes for all types of investors, and think if you listen to this podcast, you will enjoy ours as well. Follow the Chit Chat Stocks podcast on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, and start discovering new investments today.
And I think people probably underestimate, it's not only a case of competitiveness and profits, but it also, and now we're seeing it play out, right? It's also a matter of political leverage, because if you are so necessary for global supply chains and for products that we use every day, then you probably can ask for more than if they don't need you for anything, right?
Right. So in the first instance, you have pricing power, right? So you can charge more. So the profitability is up. And this is why, by the way, the stock market knows this, right? Because we're now back to bubble period levels, because those companies are quite profitable. To what extent this can also be a negotiation piece in the current trade wars, we will have to watch. Japan is not that aggressive a negotiator. They don't like sort of this aggressive stance, but they could. So hypothetically speaking, if we had 100% decoupling in the world, but no trade, then nobody can make a semiconductor. But let's just say somehow we still can get rare earth, or we have rare earth, or we can recycle rare earth, or whatever it is, then Japan is the only country in the world that can actually make an advanced semiconductor within Japan. So China, of course, has a huge market share in these legacy chips, you know, of 40 nanometers and above, and that's great. But we're talking about the more smaller, more complicated ones. And certainly America cannot make this. And Europe has the machinery, right? So ASML, yeah. Of course. But by the way, the ASML machine is a marvel. It's a fabulous machine. And ASML is the Philips spin out, right? So similar story like Japan.
I actually hold ASML in my portfolios.
But here's the thing: without Japan, ASML could not make that machine. There are 10 Japanese suppliers to that thing.
I mean, ASML, a lot of people think that ASML is a machine manufacturer, but ASML is more of an assembler, because they have this whole complex supply chain. And obviously, some critical parts, they've bought them and now they are in-house, but they rely on a massive number of critical suppliers, right? And that's also why it's so tough to do what ASML does, right? Because you have to replicate a super complex supply chain.
Yeah, it really is a marvel of a machine, the 2-nanometer machine that they're now shipping to Japan, and Japan is using it, right? So it's in action, and it will take a long time until they figure this out for mass production. But it's a very interesting, you know, current day research project, and yet again, there are certain the mask, the photoresist, you know, some part of the machinery is from Japan, 100% sourced from Japan. And so there's a Japan inside sticker on that thing as well. The ASML story is interesting because they were, of course, a spin out from Philips. And so if you look at what happened to the Japanese electronics companies, it really is not that special. We've seen this before in Europe and the US. When a competitor arises, the incumbent is pushed towards specialization into the higher margin fields. And this is exactly what's happening in Japan. So ASML is a great example of, you know, Philips used to make, I mean, everything from light bulbs to, you know, extension cords or something. And now they're this, you know, and then they spun this out. So what the Japanese large conglomerates are doing right now is a similar thing. So I mentioned Hitachi before. For the last 10 years, so Hitachi is Japan's Siemens, right, or IBM. And they've decided that their 1,000 subsidiaries and, you know, whatever, how many business units, that was just too unfocused. It was too big, too unwieldy, too slow, too, you know, too much of a bureaucracy, and not the right approach for the 21st century. And so they've decided that they would pivot into becoming a smart city. This is my label, by the way, but they have smart city on the website, a smart city infrastructure and connectivity provider. And if you think about what that means, it's, first of all, there's infrastructure, right? So we need trains and you know, towers and so forth and so on. But then also the connectivity part with it. And there's also some factory automation in that and of course, electricity, power. So they're retooling some of their core businesses, and then they've basically sold off everything that does not fit this. Medical instruments to construction machinery, even to their chemical. There's actually, they had a semiconductor advanced chemical maker, which is now spun out. And so they've carved out or spun out and sort of did a big old garage cleaning. I don't know. I was cleaning, and now will they be successful? Who knows? I mean, IBM tried this and it didn't quite work.
I mean, I remember that reading your book when you were discussing the case of Hitachi. I remember looking at the stock price, and I don't know if they'll be successful, right? But the market is thus far giving them the benefit of the doubt, because the stock has performed pretty well over the last few years, and probably caused by this refocus on core activities more than on being a subsidiary. And I wanted to ask you now, so Japan in the year 2000s was a powerhouse in assembly. Then China came and wiped pretty much everyone out of manufacturing and of assembly. So now that China is also trying to go upstream, the China of the year 2000 is probably not the same China as the China that we see today. How do you think that Japanese corporations are going to stay ahead now that China is also upping the game? And you also discussed the cases of South Korea, Taiwan.
First of all, let me just say, I'm not giving investment advice here, right? Because I'm giving you these examples. I don't invest in these companies, so I wouldn't even know what prices. So let me just be clear. I like these companies because as examples for strategic shifts. So I think that competition in Northeast Asia has been completely underestimated. That there is a big old party going on, if you want to, you know, say flippantly. And of course there's a history, and we'll hear about a lot that, you know, that the Korea and Japan are there at each other's, you know, and that's all true, right? So politically, there's a lot of tension. Right now, there's actually a sort of an equilibrium. So I looked at the trade data, and if you look at just Northeast Asia, right? So Japan and China are roughly even, give or take. It depends on the exchange rate and whatnot, but give or take, similar. South Korea and Taiwan have a trade deficit with Japan because they're buying all of these chemicals and expensive. Mm-hmm. know, things that they need for semiconductor production and so forth. And China has a trade deficit with South Korea and Taiwan. So there's this very interesting situation where Japan provides these input things and it works for Japan. These markets where Japan is super powerful, until now, were actually too small for China to really, really get into. But of course, nobody wants to be dependent, right? So it works right now, but in the future, we need to have this. So there is a huge effort going on in, as you say, in those places to catch up with Japan and make a better photoresist and make a better, you know, material for this, that, and the other thing, or make that machine or copy that machine. And the Japanese companies, of course, are totally aware of this. And so they are constantly innovating. So if you go to some of these companies, it's quite amazing. The over sales ratio of Japanese companies is still one of the highest in the world.
I think the concept of innovation sabbatical that you discuss in the book is quite interesting. So maybe if you want to explain that, because I think that's pretty unique for Western standards.
Yeah, so that ties into the employment system. So one of the holdovers from the previous century is a system of lifetime employment, which creates a lot of social stability. And social stability is, of course, great, right? So people know they won't be laid off and, you know, they can build a house and start a family and all of that. And that's actually one of the reasons why this transformation that I talk about has taken 20 years, because there was a sort of a choice that Japan would not reorganize and restructure overnight and lay off thousands of people and hundreds of thousands of people, and then let's see what happens next and they can find another job. No, it was a very, very orderly, very Japanese, a sort of orderly, deliberate. So deregulation of corporate restructuring took 6 years, and then companies eventually could carve out or spin out or lay off. And so this was all a very drawn out process. The price Japan paid for doing this slowly, in particular, it is a low GDP for many, many years. And the benefit is that society remains stable throughout. So it was very costly to go slow. But arguably now we can say, you know, maybe what America is doing is even more costly with this, you know, employment at will and so forth. The second price that Japan paid for this is that the young people are a little bit unhappy, as I would be. I mean, if you had like 20 years of slow and your bosses are still the old bosses and the employment structure is still the same, you know, that's kind of tough on young people. And Japan now is beginning to have a labor shortage and needs to be innovative. So what the large companies have done is they've developed a new system, which I find quite fascinating, where in Japan, it is now allowed by the law, by the labor law, to work for two companies at the same time. I don't think we have that in Europe. It's certainly not in the US. It's a very complicated thing because of who's responsible for the benefits and, you know, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And two loyalties and how does this work and IP protection and whatnot. The Japanese system has the goal to counterbalance the unhappiness of young employees with their own company. You know, they're a lifetime employee at some large, you know, company, and they think they don't know any other company, so they think their company is particularly bad. And so what companies are doing is there's this new thing where they send people who want to do something more, you know, entrepreneurial or something, they can take a leave and work for a startup company or start their own company or go to another company, whatever they want to do, while maintaining their employment or with the promise that they can come back. So at Panasonic, for example, they can come back within 5 years to the same position and rank, no questions asked.
So they're basically allowing entrepreneurs to take the risk with a safety net.
That's exactly right. So in Silicon Valley, we think that this uncertainty fires people up and makes them work day and night and so forth. And in Japan, it's becoming clear the uncertainty of a failure is actually holding entrepreneurs back. And so this is a system where I could work for a large company, which also has social status. And, you know, and if I want to get married, you know, it's great if I'm an employee and that sort of thing. And at the same time, I don't have to do this illegally or on the side or over the weekend in a garage. I can actually officially just join a startup company. And then what the large company gets, of course, two things. One, the employee is happy. They realize that the other company is not better. They come back and say, it's actually very nice here. You know, this is great. I'm all fired up. And they learn something, right? They get a new idea. They get a new technology inside. They learn something that they bring back into the organization. And then that helps with changing the culture and the work habits and so forth and so on of the company. It's a small program. It's not as if everybody in Japan is on innovation sabbatical, right? It's a small program, but at the margin, I think it will make a difference. And I think it's a very interesting concept that shows you how much Japan actually cares about maintaining employment and stability. And I find that is probably the biggest difference.
I mean, I think that even though it's a small program, just the fact, or even for example, even though the transition, for example, that's happening in financial markets, right? That now the government is sort of incentivizing companies to reinvest more of their money to not have huge cash balance sheets or cash on their balance sheet. I think even though if that takes time, just seeing that the government is behind it and you really know that they care about it, right? It's not like, okay, we're leaving the private markets to do this. No, it's like we're trying to drive the change. And eventually, even if it's in 5 or 10 or 20 years, it will happen if it comes from above and culture is like conforms with it. I was very surprised when I went to Japan how there's basically nothing to tell you that something is wrong. But society will have a way to tell you that it's wrong. So you don't want to feel left out and you'll conform to what society does.
That's right. So it's a what we international business, we call tight, it's a tight culture where people very much agree what the right behavior is. And if you somehow behave differently, they'll look you down. Right? You can tell in the Japanese subway, tourists that have recently arrived will chat noisily. Even on the first ride, or maybe on the third ride, who knows? They're being looked down, and tourists too become silent on the subway. You know, at home, we chat on the subway. You know, everybody chats on the subway, right?
I must say, I was one of those tourists.
We don't know, but how did you learn? But that is the miracle behind it. And you learn because you want to fit in. You don't want to be the bloody tourist, right? And so you look around and say, why is nobody talking? Okay, mm-hmm. I better shut up. And so there's that element to it, which can be quite oppressive, right? So I've chosen not to live in Japan because I'm kind of too loose for Japan. I like it there. I love it there. I go often and happily. But after a while, I actually feel that it is quite confining. And there are interesting moments around this area. But by the way, that is also at the heart of the Toyota production system and its execution, that everybody knows that it's important to pay attention and it's on time and it's, you know, so, and it has great advantages for what Japan is good at, especially the chemical industry.
Something that stands out to me, and it's also something that the government is trying to incentivize, is that Japanese corporations, the digitization across the corporations is pretty low. And for me, it's surprising, right? Because you're talking about one of the most technologically advanced countries, but then inside the corporations, what you see is a lot of paper, not really digitized, or very old systems. Do you think that has to do with also with the tight culture of the country?
Yeah, that is one of those things, right? It might be a little bit overdrawn, right? The jokes about the Japanese are still using faxes. Actually, all offices around the world are still using faxes. But yeah, it's true, right? There's still a lot of paper. And there's maybe even worse, right? There's a lot of inventories and Excel sheets mm-hmm. that, you know, that is not even in the cloud. I mean, you have to get an Excel sheet to see the inventory. It's quite yesteryear. So I think there are two reasons for that. In the 80s, as you just said, Japan was actually at the forefront of this, right? And so Japanese companies were really quite ahead in their computerization, if that's the right word. That was the word at the time, right? So the communication and computers, and they set up their own digital systems on premise. Every large Japanese bank and every large Japanese companies has somewhere in the basement their own huge, you know, system. And in some cases, it runs on Windows 7 or something. And this is actually a big challenge now because the chip makers have announced that they will no longer make those legacy chips. So this is over. So it's a huge investment story, right? And then the second thing is, okay, clearly, the next thing is to put this in the cloud. Can we trust the cloud? And there is a expectation in Japan, which is a very fundamentally different expectation. Let me give you a simple example and then we can come back to the cloud. In the United States, and I think in Europe, if you buy something, it's your responsibility whether you like it or not, right? It's you buy a car, you know, and then if you don't like it, you know, tough luck, you bought it. Maybe you can return it, but no, not really. And so it's the caveat emptor. It's a, you know, the buyer bears the risk of this transaction. In Japan, the company is seen as being responsible for the happiness of the buyer. Right. And so the company in Japan, it's a corporate social responsibility baked into the system. So the company is in charge of making sure the employees are okay, so no layoffs and that sort of thing, right? And that the customer is okay. And there is a huge expectation that happens, and out of that come these long-term trade relations that are actually quite powerful. If you think about it that way, then you can see why it would be complicated to put stuff in the cloud. Because our thinking is, okay, so our data in the cloud, if that gets hacked, then it's the cloud provider's fault, right? It's mm-hmm. whatever, AWS or Google or whoever is running that thing, right? Yeah,
you. I mean, I think in the West, companies would be pretty fast to issue a press release saying whose fault it was.
Not mine. Yeah. We paid all this money to the data services provider. In Japan, the CEO would have to fall on their sword, right? Because they did not uphold their responsibility and fiduciary duty over the customer data. And so that's why they're going so slow. Now, is there a silver lining to the story? I don't know, but it's actually possible that by waiting so long, this digital cliff that Japan is trying to jump over now, going from the 1980s to the 2020s, they might actually end up with the best system of all of us, because they're starting from scratch now. Whereas we have all of these patched together things, right? So that maybe this story will have a happy ending. But I do like this idea that the company is responsible. On this, there's no blame passing around, right, in Japan in the same ways.
I mean, at the end of the day, even if you're outsourcing something, you're responsible for outsourcing that. If you outsource it to a provider that can fall, then it was your responsibility, probably not doing the appropriate due diligence on who are you are outsourcing to.
True. So we do have that to a certain extent, but maybe not this excessively. Yeah.
So Ulrike, I think it's been a great conversation. I think we've pretty much touched on every topic, from the transition to also some relevant trends in Japan, like the labor market and digitization. So thank you very much for coming, and I highly, highly recommending your books, because if you are interested in Japan, which I think you should be, because it's an incredible country story and business story. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. That was fun. Thank you.